All right, I want to cover one more area, and there are a lot to cover here. On the mandates, and you indicated your concerns about the mandates, but it was interesting to find that the Heritage Foundation in 1989 said that, and I quote, "There is an implicit contract between households in society that since Americans will care for someone whether or not he or she has insurance, that we should not allow these freeloaders to basically go on without paying." If that's true, I mean, if we're, and we have, we made a contract in this society that no one is going to go without health care, and we cover individuals, but then obviously somebody has to pick up those costs. If that's true, then why shouldn't we say to them, get coverage?
Well, two things. One, I do think it's true, that, and I think it says something to Chris's introductory statement. I think it says something great about us as a country, and it says something about how we treat the most vulnerable members, that we are committed, and we should be committed on a bipartisan basis, that we're not going to let people suffer. We're not going to let people, you know, not enjoy access to the health care they need at that most critical and most vulnerable point in their lives. But having said that, that doesn't mean that you have to pick the most, rephrase it in a more positive way. You should, even if you're trying to recover those costs, you should do it in the least intrusive way. Why is it that you have to pick a way that involves the federal government mandating people buy a product that they may say that they don't want? So, for example, I think, and again, this is based on news reports. I haven't had time. We've been here all day, so I haven't read the Republican bill. Like Chris, I'm looking forward to doing that. That would be a great all-night read, I'm sure. The Republican proposal that was released today, but one of the concepts they discussed was keeping the pre-existing condition coverage for insurance companies, but then, you know, having a penalty for those that don't have continuous coverage, saying, for example, one earlier version said that their premiums could go up, let's say, 40% if they didn't maintain continuous coverage. So the idea would be there's a financial incentive for you to have continuous coverage. Yes, you would still have the ability to get access, and in this case, coverage, even if you didn't and you waited, but there would be a financial penalty. Again, I'm not arguing that there's no role for government, but I'm arguing for the least intrusive form of government. Yes, I want to try to recover those costs, but I don't think that the solution is the government's going to make you go buy something. And the second part of this, and the reason why I think it's so important, you know, we're talking about, you know, benefit variability and the rest of it. Look, what's a reasonable policy for two different people in two different circumstances may be different. It may be that Bill Gates can have a higher deductible than you or me, or it may be that at a given point in life, you're willing to assume more risk for your day-to-day routine out-of-pocket costs, but you do need catastrophic coverage in case there you get, God forbid, you get into a car accident, or you're diagnosed suddenly with cancer. Other people may want more predictability and say, you know what, I really want something closer to first dollar. Now, I know Chris is going to tell me that's the difference between bronze and silver and gold, but I don't think we've done this before. This is, you know, that's like the government telling you you can have any type of meal you want as long as it's one of these three colors or flavors. The reality is there needs to be more variability. What it really comes down to me is, who do you trust? Do you trust the American people to make their own decisions for themselves, or do you think the government has to protect us from ourselves? I'm sorry, I didn't hear the answer. But
go ahead. Chris, you want to comment on this, on the mandate issue?
Well, first of all, in the Affordable Act, yes, there's platinum, silver, gold, bronze.
So four choices, sorry.
But also within those, plans can modify their benefits accordingly within the actuarial value of those categories. So there are actually, if you go look, and perhaps in your new life you may need to buy insurance, and if you do, you may want to look up healthcare.gov.
And is it working now?
And it's working. It only started working after I left, I think, government. But at any rate, you will find that even within each category of bronze, there's different deductibles, different access to providers, etc. So it's a question of not allowing plans to design their benefits to avoid sick people. That's really what we're trying to do and simplify the choices. But there are still plenty of choices. And any of you who have looked on Covered California, you'll see that. There's an extraordinary number of choices, and they're very different from even within the gold and the silver and the bronze. So I know it's great to say one size fits all and everything, and we only want to sell them black Fords and stuff like that. But no, we have options, we have choices, and I think that competition has helped constrain cost growth. Do we need to do better? Absolutely. Are there areas of the country that have done worse? Clearly. Interestingly, many of whom who haven't expanded Medicaid do worse in those states than those states who have expanded Medicaid. All these things are really important. Healthcare is a very interconnected dynamic. And woe be to the Republican Party to alter without thinking, because this is not an easy world. And if you want to own the healthcare system and call it now Trump Care, that might be something that sounds fun, but as someone who's been defending something called Obamacare, I can tell you it's not as fun as you might think.
Gentle care sounds better to me. But
gentle care.
I tried that.
Okay, I'm going to go some questions. I'm going to ask you to keep your answers as tight as you can, please. If that's probably a question for you, Bobby. If states are given more flexibility for managing health care, will guarantees, example, pre-existing conditions, coverage gaps, et cetera, be protected across state borders? What if a family has to move for work, for instance? Are these differences going to impact on the quality of care?
Sure, great question. So a couple of things. Again, under the Republican plan that was unveiled today, they do keep the guarantee for pre-existing conditions across state borders, even with the additional state flexibility. And the plan that I unveiled, what I did was we made what were called state, now they're being called state innovation grants. They've got different names throughout time, but one of the conditions for states getting those dollars was to show that people with pre-existing conditions and others could have affordable coverage. And we defined that as making sure the plan's premiums weren't greater than a fixed percentage of the median income for a given state. So yes, there would be protections across state lines. One of the things that Republicans have proposed, and I agree with, is allowing competition across state lines. And so, unfortunately, under Obamacare, what you're seeing is more and more counties don't have more than one plan. They've got more and more counties every year now having less and less competition. So this would be one more way to increase the amount of competition and the range of plans offered. But to answer the question, yes, there would be protections for pre-existing conditions across state lines.
Well, I think let's just say the devil's in the details, and we'll have to look at this policy. One of the never-ending, with respect, Republican policy priorities is across state lines. It's like, I don't know, is there anything that you like more than across state line stuff? But
I like saying former President Obama a lot. That really is former.
Good. Well, I think he looks much better these days. we're in California.
I know. I know where I am.
Hanging curveball. Okay. One of the problems with this across state lines dynamics is in the Republican world, if you have various different benefits and different rules governing it, insurance commissioners in one state are very concerned about people leaving from one state into another. They have problems, and who's the one who ensures protections for those populations? That's point one. Point two is, guess what? And Bobby knows this deep down. I think he might even acknowledge this, but when you're a plan, a local plan, you negotiate with the local hospital. You get a discount based on the number of patients that you can bring to the table. If you are buying an insurance product in Iowa and you live in Louisiana, there are not many people in Louisiana negotiating for that hospital, so the rates aren't even going to be that low. So the reason why, and this is, by the way, another mythology, is that this isn't even an option in the Affordable Care Act. It is, but the states who have tried have concluded it's a failed option. So in some ways, I go back and forth with, should I get really upset about this because I think the policy is so silly, or should I just let it happen because it won't ever really amount to beans anyway? And I go back and forth on this.
I think you should get really upset. I think that's...
All right, healthcare. This is one that obviously is we're all concerned about is health care costs. Health care costs in general in the U.S. are some of the most expensive in the world, due mostly to the fee-for-service. I think you could add technology and new developments, et cetera, in medicine. How do we reduce costs in general in the healthcare arena?
Well, look, there's several, and this is where I hope the discussion will actually center. And I want to agree with one point that Chris made. Look, healthcare is complicated, and I'm a big proponent of getting rid of Obamacare. I want Republicans in Congress to act without delay, but this is complicated, and I want them to also take the time so that folks can understand the consequences of whatever they're debating, because they are going to own it, whatever they pass. And I think that this is impacting people's lives. And I think you're exactly right. They need to understand what's the implication on the employer-provided marketplace. What's the impact on insurance rolls? What's the impact on Medicaid programs? And I think that you have to approach this with a little bit of humility. And I wish that our predecessors had. One of my biggest criticisms of Obamacare was they tried to do. When you think about it, the individual insurance market's like what, 10%? 10% of the overall insured marketplace. They made all these sweeping reforms. If they'd been really focused on those with pre-existing conditions, it didn't require this massive, massive bill. In terms of lowering cost, there's several things we know, and I think many of these are bipartisan, by the way, that we know we've got to do, and I wish that would be the focus of many of these reforms. We know that better access to preventative and primary care, and I know you're going to tell me Affordable Care Act did it. I don't think that's the way to do it, but I do think better access to preventative care. We spend billions of dollars in each state.
You can keep it and then just call it Trump Care.
And when you look at the cost of diabetes, asthma, I mean, there are all these things that we know if we did a better job of preventing on the front end or treating on the front end, you could improve people's lives and save a tremendous amount of money. Secondly, we know that moving towards more accountable delivery of healthcare, whether that's HSAs for some, whether that's managed care for others, there's not one silver bullet, but we know moving away from this just paying for activity, actually measuring and rewarding outcomes. Third, I would argue more transparency on pricing and quality data so that patients and consumers can have access. There's a fascinating little case study down in Oklahoma where one surgical center did this and it actually changed the behavior in the marketplace. For consumers, given today's technology, we should be able to have much better information about how to pick our providers, how much they cost, what their quality is. Right now, we have less information when we do that than we do when we go buy a car or go buy electronics equipment. Fourth, and we may have less agreement on this, I think we need to do something on lawsuit reforms. Now, California's been ahead of that curve. Louisiana's been ahead of that curve. There have been studies that shows that we could save billions of dollars if we applied some of those same concepts nationally, at least within the programs that are paid for by the federal government, if you want to respect the previous federalism principles. I think that we can help folks organize themselves into organized purchasing pools so they can buy healthcare. Right now, you have a tremendous advantage if you're buying it through you're buying healthcare through your employer that you don't get if you're an individual. And I think if we can organize with ERISA-like protections, folks that want to join these voluntary purchasing pools, I think there are benefits there. Within the government programs, I think more flexibility to the states with accountability. I'm a proponent for premium support in Medicare. There's an awful lot of waste in our healthcare system, and it's not just, a lot of it is fraud, but it's not just fraud. The fraud, a lot of it is because we have a pay-and-chase program that's designed to process bills quickly as opposed to actually look at what we're paying for. But fundamentally in healthcare, we've got a system that's evolved almost by accident. I mean, it's not that we sat back and said, all right, what is the healthcare system we would really want if we were designing it today? And as a result, there is a lot of waste, and there's a lot of friction between those moving parts. We could spend all day talking about the unintended cost just within Medicaid programs, because we had a program that was designed when institutional care was the dominant way to provide care and has not been adequately updated in many ways. It's kind of been bandaged together for community-based care today. So there are a lot of things we could do on disease management and preventative care. Fundamentally, I think you've got to change our tax code. I would argue for a standard deduction. That's probably a bigger discussion we've got for tonight. But I would also think that you'd have to change our legal code so that you can make it easier for people to pool their purchasing power and buy healthcare. And yes, I'm going to say it every time I can, just to drive up your blood pressure, to buy insurance across state lines.
I took my medications before this.
Chris, while you go at this issue, let me add this question as well. Recently, some products such as the EpiPen and HIV drug have made headlines due to the exponentially expanding prices. What can be done about this? What do we do? I mean, both Both Trump and Bernie Sanders have talked about controlling the price of pharmaceuticals.
Yeah. And Chuck Grassley and John McCain and a lot of other people on both sides of this. What private insurers will tell you, private and employers in the group market, is that they're seeing that pharmaceutical costs are making up a greater percentage of our overall healthcare spend. They will, they'll tell you it's as much as 20% of the premium, and that over a period of time they're worried about the future, particularly for something called single source drugs that have no competition. It's very, very difficult for the private sector to negotiate discounts if they have nothing to compete with. And so we do pretty well in this country where there's what's called multi-source drug products and generics. When you have a single source and you have an abusive pricing practice by a company, and I think people would argue that the EpiPen was, and the HIV drug products, at least when they were initially introduced, was excessive. I mean, there was an example of a company who bought, they didn't do the innovation around the drug. They bought a company who was going to price a product at $25,000, $30,000, and they ended up buying it, and they sold it for $70,000. Well, guess what? That hurts. In fact, the people that hurt the most were Medicaid programs, because you've got a lot of low-income populations with HIV, so people had to make really tough budgeting decisions. Where we need to go with this is probably more thoughtful ways to do approvals at FDA to get more competition out the marketplace, looking at some of abuses, what are called market exclusivity abuses, where there's an article today where Republicans and Democrats are raising concerns about how orphan drugs who get this extended market exclusivity period, which means no competition in return for developing these drug products, are just slightly innovating around another drug and calling it an orphan drug and then getting multiple years of no competition. That's just totally unacceptable. And there will be a lot more scrutiny. Some people will say all the way to Medicare negotiation, importation approaches. You know, the industry is going to have to be very careful about excesses in this area, because the public, even more so than the Affordable Care Act, is getting increasingly concerned about pharmaceutical costs.
Okay, still on healthcare costs. Every country that has healthcare for all citizens rations healthcare. We never hear that in this debate. How can America have affordable healthcare without addressing this issue? Chris?
Every every time the Republicans are criticizing the Democrats, they call it rationing care, and I suspect later this week we'll hear Democrats saying Republicans through their Medicaid cuts are rationing care because they're giving unrealistic resources to the states to manage coverage for low-income populations. I personally think that rhetoric is it's like death panels. It's sort of like Yes. If you have no coverage, then you are I mean, let's be honest. If you have no coverage, we're rationing care to people who have no coverage, right? I mean, that's the reality here. We do need to find ways to constrain costs. Do I believe that there's a lot of waste in this healthcare delivery system that we can squeeze out before having those tough conversations? Absolutely. There is no way that we are spending as much as we are in this country and cannot squeeze out much more efficiencies and value out of this healthcare system than we have. So sometimes people like enjoy having that conversation because they think it's manly and real and all the rest. But in the end, it just scares people away from getting anything thoughtful or constructive done.
So when the Democrats say this week, you'll be the first to criticize.
No. I'll say they're probably right.
I just want to go back to the previous question real quick, because I think Chris made several good points on the cost of prescription drugs. I think there's an interesting opportunity, and who knows where President Trump will land on this, but as a populist who's spoken out against other countries shifting the cost of developing drugs to the cost of developing these new innovative drugs to America, you could say, I'm not saying you will, but you could see some interesting unusual partnerships there. I mean, it could be consistent with some of his rhetoric on trade and some other topics. I think that's worth watching. But I also think Chris is right. If these, and I agree with all, you know, the need for more competition, clearing out the FDA backlog, looking at the the unusual alliances between companies sometimes to prevent competition. But I think he's right that these companies have to be careful. You know, EpiPen was just one of the most recent examples. There have been several of these examples. I don't think anybody in America begrudges companies that are developing true innovation, you know, recovering their cost. But I think these abuses, they've got to be very careful. There could be a backlash. Yeah. And I think the backlash could cause some very bad unintended consequences. What we do need to drive down the cost without killing off the innovation. And I think that you're right, that they've got to be very careful with their practices.
Can I just ask that we edit out those remarks that says Chris is right?
And then I would second that. That would be, it's not good for either one of us.
talking about the costs here. We've talked about this issue of subsidies versus tax credits. It appears that the Republicans are going to put tax credits into their new bill, kind of a fixed amount that will go to everybody on tax credits. So it's not going to be based on income, if I understand it.
It varies based on age.
Based on age. But as some Republicans have attacked it, this is the establishment of a new entitlement in health care. We had the pay-fors in the bill that were there. I don't know whether taxes on medical devices is out now. Or
yeah, it's out. Tax out, insurance tax out.
Pharmaceutical sales, high incomes, savings from Medicare. But initially it was designed so that it would be budget neutral. Is that going to be the case with what the Republicans put out?
Yeah, so a couple of things. One, and we were talking about this earlier, Congress, they love to play these games budget neutral because they have these 10-year windows. Well, they delayed the implementation. They front-loaded some of the subsidies. They don't grow as far, under Obamacare, so they don't grow as fast as medical inflation. So, you can look at that first 10 years and say, okay, it was budget neutral when we passed it. But, look, you look at the history of every government program, I think the reality is creating a new entitlement is going to cost us more, and I think you already see the cost pressures within that program. But set that aside. The question was about the Republican plan. I'm not a fan of some of the elements that you've just described in terms of the Republican approach. I think they're going to, and I, look, this is all based on partial reports, because originally one of the pay-fors that was thought they were going to cap the tax exclusion for employer-provided health care. It's seemingly a more, I don't want to say last minute, but a pretty recent change was they took that out of their proposal. So that was, up until a few hours ago, everybody thought that was going to be the pay for. At least from initial reports, it sounds like they're going to delay the repeal of some of those Obamacare taxes by at least another year. And again, I'm not a big fan. I need to understand more and read more about this actual approach. I'm not a big fan of this approach. You are going to have some Republicans on one side that are concerned about refundable tax credits being a backdoor way to get back to the same Obamacare-type entitlement program. And their viewpoint's going to be, well, are we just basically creating the same subsidies with a new name? And how does that make it any better? And I'm sympathetic towards that argument. You're going to have others on the other side. They're going to look at the tax credit approach and wonder, unless we're doing exactly as much as Obamacare did, is that enough? I think that's the wrong approach. I think Republicans would be better off starting the conversation by saying, all right, how do we really reduce costs? How do we get at the cost drivers? Because I think if we step back for a second, we've talked a lot, and rightfully, our focus has been on quality and access, and I think that's right. As a society, we also need to be cognizant of the fact that healthcare cannot continue growing faster than the rest of our economy. We've been in this for several years now, and it doesn't matter who's president. And yeah, there have been short-term cycles where it's been slower. Maybe that's attributable to the overall economic growth or whatever. But over any reasonable period of time, healthcare continues to be growing faster than the rest of the economy. That puts pressure on state budgets. As a governor, I can tell you that you want to put that next new dollar into education or infrastructure or into tax cuts or whatever your priorities are in the state. But all of your new revenues are being consumed by Medicaid, just by the normal growth of Medicaid. I'm not talking about new enrollees. I'm not talking about new programs. I'm just talking about medical inflation. It puts tremendous pressure on most of our states require balanced budgets. They can't print money. They can't borrow money. They've got to make those tough choices. And it's putting pressure on the federal budget as well. And so we've got to have a real focus, a real discussion on how do you cut costs. I do think there's a lot of waste. I think Chris is right. I mean, I think there's some low-hanging fruit. The good news is that there's some stuff that hopefully wouldn't be partisan that we can get done, but we should start there. And I hope that we will put that as a priority in this replacement package. And I think that needs to be one of the first priorities in this replacement package.
Chris?
I'm tired, so. You can, unless you want me to.
No, okay. No, not necessarily.
He thinks the Republican approach is bad.
Let me just throw this out for the sake of rationality. We're talking about, the possibility is this bill may very well add money to the deficit just because we'll have some problems covering all of the costs,
I suspect if it's going to get out of the House, I'd be very surprised if they could get something out of the House that wasn't
budget neutral.
I just think that there are so many House Republicans that would have a concern with that. If they were counting votes, I just think that'd be, now I'm not promising that's what gets out of the Senate, but I would just imagine getting out of the House without, and you would know better than me, with the reconciliation rules, that could cause some problems in the Senate if it's not budget neutral. So I may not like the way they're doing it, but I strongly suspect whatever comes out of the House will have budget neutrality score.
I agree with that. I think that they have to find a way to get just a little bit of savings to meet the reconciliation instructions. The question, though, that we're all scratching our heads tonight is if you reduce the... If you add costs by, in essence, eliminating the revenue increasers, whether it was pharma, insurance, high-income people, pushing back the Cadillac tax, all these things, those cost money relative to the baseline. How do you get there? Now, I should just tell you all that... for some reason, sometimes, you can explain this to me, that when there's a tax cut, sometimes Republicans don't count that as, costs. But it's a sort of an innovative construct, but it's all in the economic dynamism stimulative effect. But I'm sorry.
You asked me to explain it to you. I'm going to explain it to you.
I will. But I promise I'll finish. But I suspect the way they really get to it is they back in some significant Medicaid cuts, through a very, very tight, probably per capita cap. And in the early years, because the tax credits, you eliminate the mandate, you automatically have less people covered. That reduces your costs because you're no longer subsidizing people who purchase health care. And your tax incentives to purchase health care are less than currently is in the Affordable Care Act, so you save money there. So I think it's a combination of those things that gets them to the budget.
Okay, all right, just two definitional things.
Quickly.
Okay. All right,
quickly.
Just to explain it to him, because he asked me to explain it to him. One, I think it's very interesting when Chris and other Democrats say, well, when we repeal this tax, that's a cost to government. Letting you keep more of your money is not a cost to government. That's letting you keep more of your own money. Secondly,
Bobby, point. That's like saying you're going to build a wall and send the bill to Mexico. I couldn't resist that. Listen, we're...
You have a very different audience in Louisiana. I trust it's going to be a very different reaction.
We're close to wrapping up here, but what I want to do is to get from each of you a sense of what's going to happen with this bill. Is it going to make it through the House? Is it going to make it through the Senate? Is it going to get blocked because members are so scared of what the consequences will be that they're not, whether it's Democrats or Republicans, they're not going to vote for it, and we will get no bill? Give me your best guess right now as to whether or not we will see this bill become law.
I think we will. I think that, and look, they're all. If we were laying odds, you could come up with a million reasons why this is going to fail. And I can point to all kinds of groups that are going to be opposed to it on both sides of the spectrum, all kinds of obstacles. The reason I do think that something will get through and get to the president's desk, two things. One, Republicans have been campaigning on this since 2010. This is not just one of many issues they've got to consider. This was a primary issue many voters sent them to D.C. And there was a tremendous amount of pressure on those members to get something done, and they believe in this. This is not just political pressure. It's not poll tested. This is one of the reasons they ran for office. They wanted to serve. They oppose Obamacare, whether you agree with them or not. This is a sincere conviction, and this is something they feel strongly about, and they feel like they've got to deliver. This isn't something like, oh, well, we can compromise on infrastructure, or we can make it. This is something that is a core conviction. When you think of all the new members in Congress, many of them were motivated, you know, the Tea Party Revolution forward, many were motivated to run for office in largely due to the protest against Obamacare, the increased amount of government spending and debt. So this is a huge, huge priority so there will be a tremendous amount of pressure to get something done.
So you think they'll walk the line?
Secondly,
if they have concerns.
The rumors are that President Trump's going to come out later this week, strongly endorse, or at least offer some cover. Look, in the first, you know this, both of you, in the first few months of your, you know, a president from your own party, there's going to be a lot of pressure to work. Now, the final thing I'll say, I do think it's likely something will get done. This is an incredible opportunity, and I think it's too important just to get something done and call it, we repealed Obamacare. I think there's a real opportunity to make some very important progress in cutting health care costs and improving access, and that's why I hope we do more than just repeal Obamacare. I hope we actually improve the health care system.
Well, I think that you've got, it's a really interesting political challenge. The governor is correct. You keep on campaigning and running on something, woe be to you if you don't succeed in a primary dynamic. And that's what's really motivating these guys. They really think they have to. Now, if you look at the Republican Party, though, you've got three Republican parties. You've got the complete budget hawk Freedom Caucus, who really would just be happy to repeal the thing. You've got the reformers, the philosophical people, and you've got the Republican light. Just get something off the check. I want to do some more popular things, okay? 1, 2, 3. And you've got Republican governors who've not expanded. Leon's saying hurry up. So, okay, this is really interesting, though.
What's
to me.
The bottom line?
Senate, House, Trump. There's a lot of I think the big challenge will be in the Senate. They have two votes that they can clear out, and I believe in the end of the day, we'll win.
All right. Thank you. Thank our speakers. Thanks to all of you. This is the first of many issues that we'll be debating throughout this year, and let's all hope our democracy survives.